This is CIOY 101.5 FM. The Hawk is on the air.
You are listening to Bridging the Social Distance. My name is Jenny Mitchell, and I recorded this show here at CFRU, Guelph's campus and community radio station, as a means of creating a platform for us to share ideas and feelings and perspectives in the wake of this global pandemic that is COVID-19. I was afraid that people would get isolated or I would lose the opportunity to chat with my community and find out how everyone is doing, so I made this show. If you're listening and you would like to get involved or be interviewed, you can contact me at mobile@cfru.ca. I'd like to provide the disclaimer that these interviews were recorded at different points in time, so situations in some of these locations may have changed. This show is also being syndicated for CIOY in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Ajay Heble, the artistic director of IF 2020, a 24-hour online improvisation festival happening this Friday, August 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can check out more information and check out the festival at improvfest.ca. This interview was originally recorded on August 5th, 2020. To start with, would you be willing to introduce yourself for listeners?
Sure. My name is Ajay Heble. I'm the director of the International Institute for Critical Studies and Improvisation, or IC for short. I founded the Guelph Jazz Festival in 1994 and served as its artistic director for 23 years. And I'm a professor in the School of English and Theater Studies at the University of Guelph.
Amazing. So I guess for listeners who are not familiar with what IC is, maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, so IC, the International Institute for Critical Studies and Improvisation, is a partnered research institute centered at the University of Guelph, but we have partnerships with universities across Canada, so McGill in Montreal, University of British Columbia in Vancouver, University of Regina in Regina, Memorial University of Newfoundland in St. John's, and the University of California in Santa Barbara. So they're all partners of a research institute that's hosted by us at Guelph. And we also have probably about 40, maybe closer to 50 community partners that are involved with the institute. So these range from music festivals to social service organizations that work with aggrieved or at-risk populations, to hospitals and healthcare centers, to foundations and museums and art galleries. So really quite a wide-ranging group of partners, again, all around the world. And the research that we engage in tries to focus primarily on the role of improvisation as a vehicle for social change. So in what ways can artistic models of improvisation, and we're talking about improvisation as it's played out across the arts. So my expertise, of course, is music, but we have people who work in theater and dance and other disciplines as well. The work that we do looks at how improvisatory practices across the arts can play a role in promoting social change. And we often partner with social service organizations. So in Guelph, for example, we have a long-standing project with Kids Ability Center for Child Development, which is an organization that runs programs for kids that have physical and developmental disabilities. We've been organizing workshops with kids, with youth at Kids Ability, which will often culminate in public performances where the kids and the facilitators perform live, including at the jazz festival in front of thousands of people. It's really quite exciting. And the research component is that we have our students or members of our research team tracking the work. So we document the performances and the workshops. We interview the participants, the youth, the staff at Kids Ability, the musicians and the artists who facilitate the workshops, all with an aim to try to track the impact that this is having on these communities. And we're running similar projects around the world. So we have similar projects in Canada, in Montreal, with some street-level youth in Montreal, and with homeless people on the downtown east side of Vancouver as well, in partnership with the Carnegie Center. So quite a wide range of partners involved in this project, all kind of focused on looking at improvisation as a model for change. So that's a very quick summary. And it's a research institute, so we publish books. We have a journal, a website, but we also do a lot of community-engaged work with these partners.
So it started here, correct? Like, you are the kind of core facilitator, even with all of those other partnering universities and spaces contributing to the body of work. It is rooted and facilitated here?
That's correct. So I am the director of the Institute, and it started, it really was initiated at the University of Guelph. And in many ways, even before that, it was kind of an outgrowth of my work with the Guelph Jazz Festival, because, as I'm sure you know, for many years, from early on in the festival's history, for many years, we've been running an academic colloquium, a conference, an international conference as part of the festival. And that grew very quickly. So people would come from all around the world to attend the colloquium as well as the festival. They'd give presentations. Then they started to ask, well, you know, might we be able to publish these things? And so we launched the journal, which led to this international network, which has now led to these larger projects.
What was the timeline of that initial conference series at the festival?
Oh, I think the first conference was 1996.
Oh,
so
wow.
I started the festival with a small group of friends. First edition was 1994. And the first festival, the first conference, which was a smaller version, it was maybe a day long, maybe 2 days, was 1996. And then I think from then on, it soon moved to a 3-day international event. So, and it's been running annual. This is the first year we have not done it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think that I was not aware that you were running that conference as well as the jazz festival, because I know that seems like an insurmountable amount of work, to be honest.
Yes. And then, of course, for 4 years, we also ran Nuit Blanche as part of the festival.
Right.
So we expanded the festival's program of activities to include, on the Saturday of the festival, we had all-night programming, so probably another 75 events taking place all around Guelph all night.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because it's a research piece and it constantly will change and be informed by the new things you're learning and the new people participating and our changing world, I'm sure the objectives or goals or, you know, what you're most curious about changes all the time, but do you remember why, or like what the original purpose was, what you were curious about when you very first started exploring it?
Well, I think that, to be honest, the initial impetus for the conference was to try to find a way to bring together my academic work with my work in the community. So I was basically running a volunteer, you know, organizing a volunteer powered festival in the early days in 1994. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to find a way to link my volunteer commitment in the community with what I was doing academically? And so I thought, well, let's try organizing a conference. And then, of course, the idea became, well, how do we expand the kind of interest in the festival, right? So the Guelph Jazz Festival, pretty much from its inception, sought to do something a little bit different from most of the other festivals in the country, or even, you know, on the continent, in the sense that it was providing a venue for avant-garde and experimental music, primarily. Mm-hmm. And it brought to its stages artists that you might not hear at the other festivals. And because it was focused on innovative, cutting-edge avant-garde music, we had to build an audience. And, you know, I knew that we would get an audience of aficionados, but I also wanted to build a community audience. I wanted people who might not know about the music to learn to appreciate it. And the colloquium, pretty much from the early days, more than any other aspect of the festival, I think, contributed to that audience building. It helped to build an audience for music that in some other context might have seemed to people to be difficult or off-putting or challenging, because you would hear the artists in intimate settings in those early days, probably for the first 20 years or something. The colloquium took place at the art, what is now the Art Gallery of Guelph. It used to be called the McDonald Stewart Art Center. So a beautiful indoor, you know, setting, small, intimate, up to 100 people maybe. And you would be able to interact with the artists, so you could meet them, you could talk to them, you could hear about what they were doing, you could watch them actually improvise on stage in a small group and have a conversation with them afterwards. So I think the colloquium really, more than any other aspect of the festival, helped to build an audience for that music that might otherwise have seemed challenging or off-putting to people. So I think, again, you know, thinking back to those early days, one of the goals around the academic piece was certainly to try to build an audience for the music that people were hearing at the festival. Because for me, it was about having both the aficionados who would travel from around the world, and they did, to attend, but also trying to build a local community of a local community audience for the music.
It's so interesting because as a person who's gone to lots of different festivals and lots of different places, I haven't really heard anything described quite like this. Like working in community radio, I absolutely, it resonates with me, the idea of providing a platform or a stage for content that should be heard, and that being different than programming to attract the masses based on popularity. But the idea of building in a piece to educate and grow an audience, especially over several decades at this point, is fascinating. It's like you can create a body within the community that at some point you'll have a generation that never knew a time before this being familiar.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. And the other amazing thing that has happened, and certainly unbeknownst to me when this all started, is we've now developed an academic field of inquiry. So critical studies and improvisation, right? So what started with a festival, which then became a conference, which then became an academic journal, has now led to this international network and set of partnerships that have created a brand new field of scholarly inquiry. Mm-hmm. So, we've defined a field, basically, and not something that we would have imagined doing when we dreamed about putting on a festival in 1994.
Well, I have a burning question that it's maybe not even a fair question, but something that always strikes me when I think about the idea of studying improv and is how do you study something that in its very essence is meant to be unpredictable or not? I mean, is that a question you get all the time?
It is a question that often gets asked, yes.
Okay. Then I don't feel so mean.
No, it's a fair question. I think that there are many ways to try to answer that, but one would be to acknowledge that improvisation, despite what people might think, doesn't come out of thin air. Mm-hmm. Right, that the best improvisers have years and years of practice, and they've developed protocols of inquiry that shape what they do, and it emerges out of historical context. So, a lot of the work that I do has to do with experimental forms of improvised music that have emerged out of African-American traditions, and they're very much out of that African-American history, and they're tied to moments of resistance, to sounding off against structures of oppression, using improvisation and dissonance as artistic practices to model ways of challenging structures of fixity. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's a myth that improvisation is just something that comes out of nowhere, that it isn't tied to any history, that it's just in the now, that you can't really teach it. But, I think Jesse Stewart and I have just co-authored a book which is about improvisation and pedagogy. And, that's often something people would ask about improvisation, right? Like, how do you teach it? It's a great way to start a debate among improvisers to talk about, can you teach improvisation? I think that, we interviewed a number of artists, and I think they would all agree that improvisation in some ways can be taught, but the ways in which it's taught might not be traditional classroom instruction. It's often taught by doing, it's taught by listening, it's taught by, picking up a recording and listening to it, it's taught by going to concerts, it's taught by collaborating with like-minded musicians. So these are all things that we've discovered in talking to other musicians. But yeah, of course, it's a fair question.
Yeah, the fascinating thing about talking about this subject with you, for me, is my profession and interviewing is rooted in improvisation sense that, I feel like it feels more honest for listeners to follow my train of thought as I listen and think of questions, but it is hard to articulate. But I really relate when you say that it isn't crafted out of nowhere. It's years of experience of authentic listening and, you know, realizing, like, connecting to pieces, I guess, like when you can hear something that you can respond to, right? And so I feel like we're not dissimilar in a way, even though our forms are so very different.
For sure,
One thing I'm curious about, though, so for me, for example, to have this interview with you, I do know a bit about you, obviously, but I don't necessarily need to know much about the person I am talking to or interviewing to be able to follow them and work together.
Yeah.
For your students who are researching this, how much context and information or history of the people they're witnessing do they need in order to be able to study it? So are people looking into all kinds of background information around histories and context and genres before then watching people perform and seeing how that affects it? Or are they also able to watch what's happening and draw conclusions without a lot of that context?
I would say it varies from student to student. So as you may know, we have a brand new graduate program. There's no undergraduate program, but we've just launched a master's and PhD program, the first of its kind in the world, as far as we know, in critical studies and improvisation. So part of the field building that I talked about earlier. And our first cohort, which entered the University of Guelph last fall, we have 10 students. And that's a mix of PhD and MAs. And I think, you know, each student is doing something different and they come from different backgrounds. So we have many students with backgrounds in music, but we have some who have backgrounds in sociology and political science, some in theater studies. We've had interest from people had interest from a medical doctor who's thinking about applying to do a PhD with us. So it really is quite wide ranging. And so to answer your question about how students would conduct their research, I think it really varies. Depends on what the students are working on. I think in most cases, there's going to be some kind of historical or contextual element that's going to shape what they're doing, or some kind of interviewing with the people that they're working on. But there will also be some kind of in the moment, capturing an observation, like if they're filming something or documenting something, they're going to be observing what's going on in that moment. But what they're analyzing in that moment will likely be informed by what they've discovered about the history and the social and cultural context. It's hard to generalize, but I think that would be a kind of a standard response without, being able to talk about particular research projects because they are so varied.
I think I can follow you there. It can help to have sort of a goal or a lens to be witnessing or learning from that is informed by whatever you bring to the table in terms of your previous research or where the field you work in, but it's still being present and not ever being able to predict what you actually will learn. It's sort of like, you have to be open enough to be taking in all of the new and unexpected, but still have some sort of lens or filter that's relevant to you for actually learning from it.
You should do our graduate program, Jenny.
Well, I think it would be extremely helpful for people to learn about that type of learning, regardless of field. My previous interview today was with people who work in retirement residences, and the need for people to be present and authentically listening and constantly improvising and responding to changes in circumstances is integral to doing that work, for example. And you'd think it's worlds away from what you do, but I don't really think it is.
No. We have, I think I may have mentioned, we had a doctor who was interested in our PhD program. We have a surgeon on our research team. He's the head of surgery at a major hospital in Toronto. We have lawyers on our team. So Joel Backen, who's the author of The Corporation, is a member of our research team. David Lametti, who's the current Minister of Justice in Canada, is a member of our research team. So, it's really interesting. You would think that surgery and law are fields that are miles away from improvisation, but in fact, they're not. And these people argue, like the first time I met this surgeon, John Semple, he was just an attendee at one of our conferences during the jazz festival, because he's a music lover, I think. And he announced himself from the audience asking a question. He said, "I'm a surgeon and I improvise daily with what I do." And we thought, yes, we need to talk. But you wouldn't think of that normally, right? But I mean, I have my own experience that you may know about. I had a heart attack on a plane coming back from a conference in Paris. And the person who saved my life was a doctor. He just happened to be on board that day, and he improvised. He improvised a miracle on that plane. And he talks about what he did as improvisation. So you want your surgeon, you want your doctor to be a good improviser, because you can't always predict the situations in which you're going to find yourselves, right? So, and I think we have a number of legal scholars who say the same thing, that you know, good lawyers, good judges need to be adept at adapting to the moment. And these are really, improvisation are vital tools. Being able to improvise is a vital tool for being a good lawyer and being a good judge.
So recognizing that your students will have different professional areas of interest or personal or creative areas of interest that drive why they want to do this work, the social change piece that you speak of, is that where your own personal research comes in? Is that your sort of drive and focus within the studies?
That's certainly one of my key pieces, yes. I mean, most of, if not everything, certainly most of the work I'm doing in terms of my own research is driven by a kind of social change agenda. So whether it's work I'm doing in through IC, or the work that I do in the English department and the books and research that I do there, community engaged pedagogy, human rights education, education for social justice, looking at improvisation as a model for social change, these are the areas that interest me. And I think because the graduate program in improvisation also has a kind of a strong community engaged focus. For example, we allow or we encourage students to do internships with our community partners as part of their program of research. I will be teaching this fall, starting this fall, a course on arts-based community making. So it's deliberately meant to be a course in community engagement and improvisation. So there is, I think, there's as a thread that runs through the graduate program in improvisation studies, social justice is there. So, yeah, I mean, it's certainly part of my research, but it's also, I think, core to the research that most of my colleagues in the NIC are it's core to their research as well, I would say.
Can you talk a bit more about where social change and improvisation intersect?
Yeah, it's a big topic. So I've co-authored books on this. There's a book that I co-authored with Daniel Fishlin, my colleague at Guelph, and George Lipsitz, who's a colleague in California, called The Fierce Urgency of Now, which is a book about human rights and improvisation. And we make the argument, essentially, that improvisation has long functioned in ways that have served as a kind of catalyst for social justice struggles. So, I mean, there are countless examples that we document in the book, but essentially, again, it's something I said earlier, improvisation has played there's a long and illustrious history of the role that improvisation has played for aggrieved communities, specifically African-American communities, as they've sought to sound off against systems of oppression. So I think of the example I often give is Paul Robeson, who was, of course, a human rights activist who's passport was confiscated. He was prevented from crossing the border. And I think it was, I don't know the exact year, but off the top of my head, I think it was 1952 when he gave the famous Peace Arch concert. He had to improvise on the back of a flat, on the back of a homemade stage on a flatbed truck, just miles from the border, which he was not allowed to cross. And he sang to thousands of people on the other side of the border. So using the materials you have at hand in the arenas that are open to you in order to make a way out of no way, sometimes in even the most discouraging circumstances. That's how we define improvisation, right? So improvisers have always worked with the tools they have in the arenas that are open to them in order to imbue the world with the possibility to make right things transpire. And they often work without a written score or a script. and they create things that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. So think of fall ropes and standing on the back of that flatbed truck, not allowed to cross the border, singing, improvising with what he had and singing to those people on the other side of the border, to thousands of people. The other amazing thing about that is, I don't know if you know this story, but he changed the words of Old Man River, which could have been a racist show tune. So instead of singing, "Get a little drunk and you land in jail," he's saying, "Show a little grit and you land in jail." Mm. So he changed the crime from drunkenness to resistance, right? And suddenly, what would have been a racist show tune becomes a very powerful and enduring moment of resistance and hope for a grieved population. So, I mean, that's a really interesting example of social improvisation. But I also think of I've also written about how Dr. Martin Luther King's famous "I Have a Dream" speech. The dream part of it was improvised. He responded to a comment that Mahalia Jackson, the singer, shouted out to him from the stage. She said, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream," in the middle of his speech. And then he abandoned his notes and started. He made what is now the most famous speech and political speech in world history, right?
Yeah.
Or I think about Max Roach talking about how African-American musicians had made something out of nothing, how that's how turntablism happened, right? Like you took objects that you had and you made music out of them. Mm-hmm. So there are these long and illustrious examples, not to mention the roles that have been played by arts organizations like the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians in Chicago and others. So these are all things we talk about in our book, The Fierce Urgency of Now. But those are just some examples. And that's just from a musical context, but other researchers, I think, would be interested in talking about other examples. The other very brief example I can give you is work we've done around partnering with our community organization. So I mentioned KidsAbility. I think we're kind of interested in the way in which improvisation has impact on communities. So in this case, it's communities, people who have developmental and physical disabilities, and the forms of social cohesion and community building that can be, the ability for improvisation to help build community for those people. And so by running those projects and tracking the research results, we've seen tremendous impacts, and we've documented those impacts through our projects with KidsAbility in a series of films. So you can find those on our website. So those are just some brief, very brief examples.
Yeah, they're powerful examples. I mean, the KidsAbility one, when I've done radio with some of the same participants, when you're doing something that has never been done before, when you're truly making it person-centered, And kind of, improvising or winging it or whatever you want. One of the beautiful things there is you can't compare it to anything else. So if folks have in other environments experienced feeling like their disability or something sets them apart or makes them unable to meet a certain very strict and specific goal, when you are doing something that's truly centered around them, there is no comparing to each other or to even a different day or a different time. And so it's sort of impossible not to see some success there and some real excitement and empowerment, right?
It really is amazing. And we keep hearing from the kids and their parents and the workers at KidsAbility how much, how impactful these projects have been. Like we hear about showing how the kids have shown leadership skills. Like they're willing to get up in front of an audience during the jazz festival, for example, in front of thousands of people and take on a leadership role in conducting the whole band. And the parents will say, "I've never seen my kid do something like that." Or the kids themselves will admit that they're listening in ways that they've never listened before. They're hearing things they haven't heard before. Or showing, an ability, bringing people together, kind of social cohesion, social communication skills. So all of that is really, really interesting to hear about the impacts that the work is having. You're right, it's very powerful.
You're listening to Bridging the Social Distance, a show recorded here in Guelph at CFRU as a platform for sharing stories and perspectives during the global pandemic of COVID-19. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Ajay Heble, the artistic director of IF 2020, a 24-hour online improvisation festival that starts this Friday, August 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you can check out that festival at improvfest.ca.
Yeah, I think there's so much to be said for leaning into different strengths. And that's where the community piece to me really comes into play, is that there's no expectation nor no need for everybody to have the same skill set or the same goals or same interests. If you create an infrastructure where we all can lean into what we want to explore, what comes naturally or what is exciting, it naturally tells a sort of meaningful and diverse story instead of everybody trying to learn everything and do everything the same. It doesn't really make sense to build community where you all have the same skill sets or the same goals.
It's very true.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing from your previous examples that jumps out, the role of sort of resistance or overcoming. I grapple with this all the time, where some of the most inspiring stories I read about people in creating change or new things coming out. And I even think of the pandemic we're going through right now. I've done a lot of thinking about silver linings and about the opportunities to learn and things to be better on the other side of crisis. Mm-hmm. But it's also constantly, you know, heartbreaking to read stories about the barriers being there in the first place. And I'm curious, like, when you're doing this work, how you manage, like, there must be so many times you're reading about these examples, and yes, the success is huge and beautiful, and yes, you wouldn't have been able to recognize the power, or it wouldn't have existed quite that way if it hadn't been overcoming a barrier. But so often you feel like that barrier shouldn't have been there in the first place. That person shouldn't have been held up at the border. That person shouldn't be operating from a place of poverty. So I'm curious, do you think there's a way to still study this? Do you think there's a scenario where there's fewer and fewer obstacles, where people are given more and more platforms, more and more opportunities, and they still can show amazing success and brilliant outcomes without us having to compare it to what they overcame to get there?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I like to believe so. Yes. I would like to believe. Yes, I think, we see it in music making, right? If you think of the improvisational encounter in music as the starting point for this, you know, for considering this dilemma that you've outlined, if we want to call it that. I think about moments during the jazz festival when I would bring together musicians to improvise, and I suppose the challenge there is simply that they might not have a language in common, or that they might not know each other until they get on stage together, and they have to learn to communicate. But they do, and it's not, I mean, so the example there I'm thinking of, which is also a very powerful one, is not about resistance necessarily. It's not about challenging any obstacles, I don't think, other than perhaps the obstacle that might be relevant in some contexts where people don't have a language in common. But, I think of that example where musicians come together in an ad hoc situation and can create wondrous music. I think about how that can offer us a life lesson and what it means to listen to one another, mm-hmm. right? Which is a very important life skill. What it means to negotiate difference in the context of community. What it means in terms of issues of trust and belonging and social obligation and accompaniment. All of those things, right? And so I think the answer would be yes. I do believe that there is absolutely room for a kind of vision of improvisation that doesn't rely on it being a resistance to some set of obstacles. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually can really relate. Like, as a musician myself, I've often said that I prefer to not learn everything about the instruments I play, because then I feel like I'm really present with my learning as the songs come out. And I've often commented, if I knew everything about my instrument, where would the ideas come from? And it's interesting to hear you describe this scenario where you maybe have a bunch of musicians and they are supported and they aren't, they're not overcoming barriers that are problematic, but they're still given a new environment to work together where that learning and exploring still happens, but it's a healthy and exciting kind of presence as opposed to a problematic one. So I guess, like, yeah, you can't maybe learn everything ever, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it's, maybe that's a nice point at which to transition into the festival.
And, yeah, let's
well, and also I'm thinking of the pandemic, right? Because some ways what you just said got me thinking about the time we're in right now and how we emerge out of this time into something more positive. And I'm thinking of Arundhati Roy's comment, the author, Arundhati Roy, who said in a recent article that historically pandemics have forced people to break with the past and to imagine the world anew. I love that idea. Imagine the world anew. And she says that pandemics, and this one is no different, pandemics are like portals and, you know, a transition between one world and the next. So what does that next world look like? And that's kind of what this festival that, we've organized, if I may lead us there, is trying to do, right? It's trying to imagine what that world could look and sound like. You know, we're confronted with this situation in which we found it difficult to gather in communities. And I think we're all missing that, right? So we're doing this interview at a distance. I'm in the Gaspé. I don't know where you are, probably.
I'm in Guelph, in my room.
we're online, you know, but we're not able to attend many concerts and haven't been able to for so long. Musicians are having a difficult time earning a living wage, like all of these things, right? So it just seemed to us that there was an opportunity here. So what might it mean to imagine the world anew in this context? And I was really inspired by some of the things that I was seeing other people were doing. So you might know about Urgent, which is an organization that some colleagues and musician friends and others in Toronto have mounted over the last several months and during the time of the pandemic. It originally, so Urgent, U-R-G-N-T, there's no E, Urgent. And they started by organizing a series of live streamed concerts that would take place in venues in Toronto, but the venues would be empty. So they would be filming in like well-known venues in Toronto, like famous venues with concerts, but there'd be nobody there, but they'd be filming them and broadcasting them, live streaming them. And they were crowdfunding or, you know, funding online to pay the musicians. So everyone was being paid, the camera people, I believe, the artists who participated were being paid. And when I saw that, I thought, this is brilliant. I just love it. So I was happy to get involved to donate to it, but was inspired also to think, oh, what could we do? And then some friends of mine in Italy, with whom I've worked before, the University of Padua, they've been doing projects as part of UNESCO International Jazz Day for the last several years. And I've spoken at their events a couple of times and participated in their program. This year, because of the pandemic, and of course, Italy was in lockdown, right? They were really hard hit, but they still wanted to do something. They were also really committed to this idea of, you know, building a community online. So they ran a 24-hour event and they asked people to submit short videos that they would post online during a 24-hour period. And they called it Pansodia. And they asked me to contribute a piece or two. So I did. And it was great. It was very inspiring to see what they did. So those two events, Pansodia and Urgent, got me thinking, well, why don't we do something? And so we applied for a grant at the University of Guelph, which was meant specifically as a response to COVID-19. Funding that was made available for research-related projects that were a response to COVID-19. And so we pitched a multi-pronged project, part of which is this festival, and part of which is a special issue of our journal, Critical Studies and Improvisation, which will focus on responses to COVID. And we were granted some funds. And we also had some money from our partnership with the Music Eddies Foundation, which was actually earmarked for another project, but it's a project we couldn't do this year because of the pandemic. And we they seemed happy for us to use it for this festival. So we were able to use those funds to pay the musicians who are participating in the festival. It was fully curated. So we invited artists. It wasn't an open. We decided if it were an open call, it would be a zoo, right? We'd just be overwhelmed. So we thought, okay. Basically, I thought I'm just going to invite my friends people who I've made friends with and worked with over the years at the festival. So in some ways, it was a random list, you know, based on, you know, these many, many people I've worked with. But then we also thought, let's reach out to partner organizations. So I think we've got about 20 organizations all around the world. So they range from the Onassis Cultural Center in Greece to LaSalle College for the Arts in Singapore to the Sonic Arts Research Center in Belfast, Northern Ireland, to the Institute of Critical Studies in Mexico City, to Molde Jazz, which is, I think, the oldest jazz festival in the world in Norway, or one of the oldest jazz festivals in the world, which is happens to be in Norway, to a number of other coastal jazz and blues, which puts on the Vancouver Jazz Fest in Vancouver, Suoni per il Popolo, which has a month-long festival of experimental music in Montreal, and so on. So all these organizations have come on board as partners. And what we asked of them is that if they would co-present artists with us. The Dance Fest, the Eden Mills Writers Festival here in Guelph, or there in Guelph, have also contributed. So it's really quite exciting. They've supplemented the reach of our programming by co-presenting artists and sponsoring them as well. So we've got about 150 artists from all around the world, 20 different countries, I think, or more, different disciplines, so musicians, dancers and choreographers, filmmakers, videographers, visual artists, poets, spoken word artists, writers, all kinds of other. Yeah, it's quite amazing the range of artists.
I can totally understand. I mean, it's a super exciting idea. For you personally, what is your goal? Like, what are you looking forward to exploring with this? Is it more about capturing people right now during this crisis or exploring what the other side looks like?
I think it's both. I think that part of the goal here was to, I mean, at this time when we are, you know, being asked primarily to shelter in place and to keep our distance from the communities, you know, that we might normally belong to, I wanted to give people an opportunity to belong to an online community, to still feel a sense of the kind of community you would feel if you were at a festival. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've always maintained that festivals, I just said this in an interview I did with for a newspaper or for a press release the other day. Festival, you know, when I did the jazz festival, I would say, of course, the festival is about the music. But for me, it's about so much more than that. It's about reinvigorating public life with the spirit of community. And I'd like to believe that that is something we can achieve with IF 2020, that we can give people a sense of community at this time when it's been increasingly difficult to feel that sense of community. So that for me is part of it. I mean, there, you know, obviously we wanted to give artists an opportunity to reach audiences, maybe to reach audiences they might not normally reach because it's around the world. Anyone can watch this and it's free. And we're promoting it all around the world because we have partners all around the world. So, you know, we wanted artists to have an opportunity to create art, to share their art at this difficult time, to be paid for their work, and to build a sense of community. Yeah, I think those are the main things. So in part, to answer your question, it's about the now, mm-hmm. to create a sense of community at this difficult time. But it's also about recognizing what might happen afterwards, because you know, there's a lot of talk right now about the fact that even after the pandemic has ended, whatever that might mean, we're probably going to have to see, you know, continued efforts at social distancing and live streaming and online festivals might be a thing of the future. So can we learn from this in some way? I don't know. I mean, we're being asked this question by artists. Can we take part in next year's event? We don't know if there's a next year's event. There might be. You know, I've said elsewhere that at the Institute, we've talked for some time about doing a festival of improvisation, and this seemed like an ideal time to do it for a variety of reasons. Whether we'll do it again, I don't know, but it's certainly something we're talking about. We'll see how this event goes.
Well, I love the event itself is born out of improvising in a time of hurdles, right? And things to overcome. And I think on a few occasions. I mean, I don't love online as an engagement piece as much as I do in person. But what has happened for me several times over and definitely has been shared with me is people are connecting with places and people that would be impossible in so-called real life.
Yeah.
And so I think there's so much more to be said for exploring and building new projects framed out of the reality of right now than trying to sort of shove old models into this less than ideal environment for those, you know?
I agree. No, I think that there is something we can learn here. I mean, it's interesting because I've always argued that improvisers have a lot to teach us. And in some ways, improvisers are very well suited to responding to the pandemic, because what we see in the submissions that people, the contributions that people made to the festival is that they are improvising with the tools they have in the arenas that are open to them in order to make the most of the situation. So sometimes that means just whatever you have in your kitchen, we're going to improvise. We're going to make music with whatever we have here. Right? Or the people that are around us, or the objects that are around us. So it really is quite interesting to see how people make the most of the situation. And improvisers have often shown us the way in these difficult situations. So it's back to this idea of making a way out of no way. Mm-hmm. That's what improvisers do.
I definitely feel like my own skills in following sort of as things are presented, they're definitely coming into play in the biggest way during this pandemic. I'd say they've saved me in this pandemic. Yeah. I don't know how, like, what life would be like if I didn't have the skills to sort of turn on my feet and go a completely different way with little to no warning.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think that's what a lot of us have learned, right? We need those skills. They're very mm-hmm. important. Yeah.
In terms of the festival itself, what can people expect? I don't know if this is one of those things that's going to happen in real time for the 24 hours, and then if you weren't there, you weren't there, or if you're going to be capturing this for people to see after the fact. Like, what are some of the actual just technical infrastructures for people that want to tune in?
Yeah, great question. It's a question we're getting a lot. There's actually a page of FAQs on our website that answers some of those questions, but the answer to that one is it's up there for 24 hours and then it's down.
Okay.
So we wanted to capture the energy of a live festival. So again, I'm thinking of the Nuit Blanche events that I organized in Guelph. That was really, in some ways, the kind of initial idea that we wanted it to capture that energy. So you have this period of, in this case, 24 hours to watch or listen. And once that is over, you won't be able to see or hear those pieces again. Now, having said that, the artists will own the copyright to their material, so it's possible they might do something with it at some future date. It's possible also that we might decide, once we can publicly gather again, we might arrange to do some kind of public screening, maybe in downtown Guelph or something. We might broadcast bits of it somewhere else on our website. But at this point, the plan is no, it's just up for 24 hours. And that's what we're telling people.
For 24 hours, can listeners explore, or is it happening linear? Like, is each performance happening one at a time in a row? And so when you tune in, you catch what's happening then?
Yes. So when you tune in, you catch what's happening. Live stream. It's all pre-recorded, but it's live streamed. Now, what I don't know the answer to is whether you can, so let's say you're in hour 12, like halfway through the program, whether you can actually scroll back to some of the earlier, because I know during the Pansodia event that our colleagues in Italy put on, there was a chunk of time where you could actually scroll back and see maybe the previous hour. Not, it wasn't like the full, whole thing, but it was in segments. So it's possible you can scrub back. I think maybe that's the phrase, scrub back to, a previous hour and watch what was happening in that hour. But generally, we're encouraging people to watch what is there when you tune in. We should also tell people, and maybe you were planning to do this, that all 24 hours are going to be broadcast live on CFRU.
That's right. Yeah.
Very exciting.
It is very exciting. I love working at the sort of place that can free up 24 hours of airwaves for an international improvised festival. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be a big question, but there have been several festival and shows I've attended that have taken on the same philosophy that they happen in real time. And if you weren't there, you missed it. Just like if you were in real life, if you missed the festival, you missed the festival. However, one thing about these technologies is that they do have the means of archiving. And the archivist in me loves what we're capturing during this time to look back on. And one thing about that for me is when I'm having conversations, say even for my radio series, that are challenging, I anticipate that some listeners will not be in the right headspace to listen to those topics while they're living through the pandemic. But that reflecting on those feelings may have a lot of value after the fact. If we do settle back into something like normal, being able to look back on what we created in a time when we were vulnerable and we didn't know will have value too. And I'm curious, even if it isn't coming out in the form of the festival, are there things you're doing from within studying improvisation that are going to try to archive some of what's happening now so that later it can be studied? Or is your field always looking ahead and not really going back?
No, I think that's a really fair question. And I think that, yes, we are interested in archiving some of this material, whether it's through IF 2020, the festival, or whether it's through some of our other projects. So, you know, we've talked about the Kids Ability projects. Those have been archived. We document them every year. Mm-hmm. We, we post the materials on our website and so on. So I just don't know what shape the contributions to the festival might take as we think about the archival question. I mean, certainly we will have the archive.
Yeah.
And we do have permission from the artists to do some kind of, you know, if we wanted to do some follow-up, and we could certainly check in with the artists again if it's a year from now or 2 years from now and the nature of the event changes. But basically what we've told the artists who've agreed to contribute is that this is the event and that you agree to allow us to use it for, you know, kind of related things, whether it's promotion or whatever. So I don't have an immediate answer to how we might choose to archive the material from this festival. There will be a lot of it, 24 hours of programming. I mean, of course, CFRU will also have 24 hours.
That's right,
And we have a radio station in Mexico City that's planning to broadcast as well, and for a Spanish-speaking audience. So but you know, at the moment, we remain committed to this idea that it is meant to be the equivalent of a live event. But I take your point about archiving, and I think it's important to be able to think about these issues, and I suspect that these will be conversations that we'll be having with our team. Well, once the festival is over.
Yeah. Well, and in terms of team, the group who has been doing this research all these years, different students at different times, but it being an ongoing body of research, do people tend to look back at what has come in terms of improvisation and the effect it's had or the social change it's created more or look forward more? Like, do people start researching and follow through on a theory or something they're observing, or do people look back, or is it a mix of both of those approaches?
I think it would be both. Again, the research interests of the students who are in the graduate program are so varied that it's hard to generalize. But I think both of those things apply. There will be students, for example, who may be working on research projects that focus on activities that have already happened. So the Kids Ability example is one, or could be another project that we've been running for several years. But then there will be others who will design their own new projects with community partners and use those as the basis for their research. So it really is both, I think.
It is both. Okay. Yeah. Well, I have two questions I've been asking most guests, and I would love to ask you. And one is around support. So recognizing that those of us out there who have our improvising skills maybe have hit the ground running in some cases and figured out how to navigate this pandemic, but obviously there's always need for support. I mean, all the time, even when we're not living through a global crisis together. I'm curious if there's anything that has jumped to mind as being a good example of support. So either something you've seen working that you would encourage people to practice to support each other right now, or something you would love to see implemented that would really help support people who are maybe not receiving all of what they need right now.
I think obviously there's the question of financial support during a time when people are, you know, having a hard time financially, when they're laid off or when they're not able to, you know, go to their gigs or so on. But so that's one angle. And we've seen various organizations try to rise to the occasion by supporting artists. So that's one level. And our festival tries to do some of that. That was certainly part of our goal, is to be able to pay the artists who contribute. But I'm also really, I've been encouraged by another kind of support that I've seen, and that is the role that artists have played, just generally. You know, so I'm thinking of Yo-Yo Ma taking to social media to play the Bach cello, to play a Bach cello piece and host it in support of frontline healthcare workers. Or I'm thinking of numerous examples in Italy during the lockdown of opera singers standing on their balconies and singing arias across distance. Or I'm thinking of our partner organization, Nameless Sound, in Houston, Texas, where they organized a series of events called They Who Sound Special Delivery, where you could book an improvising or experimental artist to show up in front of your house at a social, respectable social distance, and that musician would improvise for you. So a way to pay the artist, but also during the pandemic, but also a way to have a little private concert in front of your house. Very, very cool idea. Or I think in Europe, in Denmark, or, you know, elsewhere in Europe, where musicians would gather on stage in front of an audience that would be in cars at an event socially, you know, so they could attend concerts. Just thinking about the creative ways in which people have tried to keep the arts alive at this difficult time, because the arts have been such a tremendous source of support for so many people and will continue to be, right? So that's something that comes to mind, is those sorts of examples.
Well, I love your answer around support. Answered my other question too, kind of around silver linings. But I do love to ask if there's something you've seen emerge during this time that really does feel like a bright spot and is maybe something you'd love to see continued or leaned into, even if we do get to return to something closer to what we think of as normal.
Well, you know, I think, again, you know, I'm thinking of that Arundhati Roy comment that pandemics have forced us to break with the past and imagine the world anew. The silver lining, I guess, would be that we can learn to do things differently in a way that's going to be more conducive to a better planet, whatever that means, right? So I like to believe that we can learn from this situation. It's not the best situation, of course, for many of us, but some good things have emerged. And I'm also put in mind of Rebecca Solnit's work. She's written very wisely about how people learn to improvise during situations of disaster. And she talks about, you know, Hurricane Katrina and how amazing acts of goodwill were improvised out of that disaster. And I think we've seen something similar during the pandemic, neighbors doing things for one another that maybe they wouldn't have done otherwise, right? Mm-hmm. Showing up and buying groceries for your neighbor and whatever. I mean, just little everyday acts that can make a big difference in people's lives, right? So I think the silver lining is that there is an opportunity here to imagine the world anew, to learn to do things differently in a way that might edge us towards a more just world.
Amazing. Well, I'd love for you to have the opportunity to share the details once more and any links that listeners may be looking for to get to enjoy the 24-hour IF Festival.
So sure, the IF 2020 Festival will take place on Friday, August 7th. Now, that is Guelph time at 8 p.m. If you're elsewhere in the world, you can find your own local start time by going to improvfest.ca. So to get more information about the festival, to find your local start time, and to tune in to watch the festival, you can go to improvfest.ca. And again, in Guelph, the start time will be Friday, August 7th at 8 p.m.
Amazing. Ajay, thank you so much for chatting with me about this today. It was so deeply interesting, and it was really nice to connect from our respective spaces. And I'm really looking forward to the festival. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Jenny. Great to talk to you too.
So once again, that was Ajay Heble, the artistic director of IF 2020, a 24-hour online improvisation festival that starts this Friday, August 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And for more information or to check out the festival, you can go to improvfest.ca. That brings us to the end of this episode of Bridging the Social Distance, a show produced at CFRU in Guelph and syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario, that aims to create a platform for us sharing what we are doing to get through this time together in the wake of COVID-19.
This is The Hawk, 101.5 FM, Hamilton's alternative.